You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
This is your host of The Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm happy to be here on a wonderful Monday. I had a great weekend with the family, and I hope every one of my listeners had a great weekend. And I'm here today with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. And to kick things off, I want to talk about something that's happening in my neck of the woods. Of course, everyone knows that the great state of Indiana is relatively socially conservative, but there is one bleeding sore of organized leftism, and that is Bloomington, Indiana. Of course, the Kinsey Institute of Sex, where they really started pushing the sexual revolution. Of course, Kinsey put the parentheses around him, of course, like to push that secretly, you know, huge amounts of the population are gay, that everyone has these bizarre Freudian sexual hangups. And traditional sexuality and morality needs to go out the window, and we need to introduce this entirely new worldview on sex that doesn't believe in the family or anything like that. So that's there, of course, but Bloomington is home to great institutions like Boxcar Books, which is our local anarchist bookstore, that actually university professors send students to buy books from. So the university actually subsidizes far-left businesses in town that actually donate money to violent anti-fascists who have committed criminal acts, raises money for them for their legal defense and to give them money on their commissary accounts and stuff like that. And they love to hold protests. Bloomington, they hold slut walks on a regular basis, of course, which we've protested, and all these different things. It's really just this hotbed of leftism in a really socially conservative, normal area. And these pop up all over the place, you know. It's like my comrades in Illinois always tell me, you're from Illinois or you're from Chicago, and they're two entirely different worlds. You know, most of Illinois, you know, it's right next door, is farmers, is normal, everyday white families, but they're held hostage politically by the forces of multiculturalism and leftism in Chicago. And very much here in Indiana, Bloomington is a space of the far left that really kind of skews things along with the black vote in Indianapolis to make what, you know, if those two cities just disappeared, would be an overwhelmingly, you know, right wing, not necessarily nationalist, but far more conservative state. But these far left organizations really have dug themselves in, have put these roots in. And in Bloomington, of course, they love to have far left organizing. And Dr. Johnson, what I want to kick off today is the students from Bernie Sanders up in Bloomington have now actually gone ahead. And of course, after the Bernie Sanders revolution ended with an endorsement of Hillary Clinton and he bought his vacation home and laughed all the way to the bank, they have now organized as a chapter of Students for a Democratic Society, going back to the 60s. I mean, you want to talk about flashbacks in American history. You know, everyone, you know, we talk about how things are kind of like Weimar Germany, but going back to the 60s here in the United States, of these not just left-wing campus organizations, but radically far-left organizations, these Bernie Sanders supporters have now joined SDS. And that's the sort of thing that's very interesting to me because it shows the polarization of American politics. So, Dr. Johnson, first of all, how are you doing? And then what do you think about groups like SDS making a resurgence on American campuses? Because this is something you wouldn't have expected even a few years ago, but the left is getting more left and they're getting more militant and vocal. It's like the 60s all over again. So let's kick it off with your thoughts.
Okay. Well, I was doing okay until you told me that news. And I'd forgotten entirely that the Kinsey Institute is there. Keep in mind also that they had taken over a Notre Dame. And about a generation ago, E. Michael Jones was teaching there at the Women's College of St. Mary's and was fired for giving a lecture against birth control. And so this is, you know, he was in the thick of it all. And there's one group that unifies all of this, and that's the Rockefeller Foundation. Rockefeller Foundation financed Kinsey from beginning to end, the Institute of Human Sexuality, as I think it's called. And the far left, sort of their enforcers, they're able to do what the state can't legally. What people forget is that between 1968 and 1971, there was something like 4,500 terrorist attacks on American soil from these leftists. It could be racial, it could be ideological, whatever it was. Every city was in flames, and they were never called terrorists. I think the body count has been deliberately deflated. With all the sensitivity about terrorism, these groups now, well, they'll never be classified as a terrorist group. They've come into existence at the same time Hillary makes her famous speech, and there's now a war on anyone on the paleoconservative right, the alt-right, which I can't stand that phrase, but it's not an accident that extremely violent group has been founded. And you're going to see them as well as the Progressive Labor Party, which is even more violent than Students for Democratic Society was. In college, I had to read all their stuff my freshman year. It was rammed down my throat. This was almost official doctrine. And, without bothering to tell us that these were extremely violent groups, they killed innocent people, and they were engaged in terrorism, thousands of incidents of terrorism throughout the country.
But of course, the thing that we are always going to hear, for instance, SDS was a huge influence, and I've read the papers on it at Kent State University, for instance, in Ohio, I believe, back in the 60s. Everyone hears about the horrible National Guardsmen opening fire on these supposedly innocent protesters, but groups like SDS were actually on the ground occupying buildings, burning ROTC buildings, attacking ROTC members and things like that. That it's kind of like the idea. I saw a really funny meme actually, where it was a picture of a policeman, and it was like a thought bubble. It said, on this normal traffic stop, I'm getting out of my car, and I'm going to risk being run through the legal system, having my career destroyed, and possibly getting myself killed just to be mean to black people for no reason, And it's just that narrative of the left that absolutely makes zero sense based on the evidence. But groups like SDS claim to be the victims. They claim that they're fighting the oligarchs, when even back in the 60s, they were committing, as you mentioned, actual terrorist attacks. And of course, there was affiliations between groups like SDS and the Weather Underground. And the Weather Underground were unequivocally terrorists. And then they ended up, the few that actually were arrested did minimal jail time, and then end up being community organizers or professors and influencing Barack Obama, an entire generation of progressive politicians and lawmakers and things like that. So these connections are just very clear. And like here in Indiana, why this is kind of striking to me, that groups like the Hoosier Anti-Racist Movement, for instance, that were caught with half a dozen of their members were arrested for committing a violent assault on nationalists at a family restaurant in Illinois. And they were caught doing this, these violent acts, premeditated with weapons, should have been attempted murder, should have been all sorts of federal charges and things like that, because they crossed state lines to commit a violent attack. And they got minimal jail time for, battery, and they were out within 2 years. And then organizations like Boxcar Books raised money for them to make sure that they got free lawyers, they got well taken care of in prison by the anti-fascist movement, and it all works together. It's this conglomerate of, as you were mentioning, the street soldiers doing what the system can't do, but being supported intellectually at the universities, having institutional support from businesses that are very sympathetic to them, having sympathetic lawyers to ensure that they never end up having to face real punishment for the crimes that they commit, where we, if we jaywalk, end up facing charges for it. But that's not how it works with the far left. So is this getting worse, do you think? It seems to me that things are incredibly ratcheting up. It kind of got into a lull after the left won the culture war in the 60s and early 70s. But it seems to be ratcheting back up again towards the 60s. And especially due to social media, we have the ability to see it. When a city goes up in flames, from Black Lives Matter or something like that, now we can see it. The system can't hide it as well. So do you see things kind of returning to a 1960s style model of the far left really being terrorists?
And yes, and having official sanction for it. There's no one I know that's active that isn't under intense attack right now. There's a lot of pressure on my bishop right now to get rid of me. You've lost several jobs recently for no other reason than political affiliation. And truth isn't important. What's important is that people are scared. They're afraid that they're going to go off to prison. because they're indirectly associated with someone who might be a nationalist. These are confused people. They're scared to death. They have nothing but prejudice. They have these twisted images from television in their minds, very confused. They don't really know what these concepts are or what these terms mean. They're vaguely threatening. They don't really understand them, so they hate them. They're bad for business. And so that's absolutely, you're absolutely correct. The premise of your question is absolutely correct. And Hillary, if we recall in 1994, the attack, the government-sponsored attack in Oklahoma City led to a whole series of laws being passed to control what was allegedly the militia movement in the far right, came under a vicious attack for a while. But now, Vladimir Putin has entered the game, at least as far as the left is concerned, and Soros and Rockefeller Foundation, all these people are connected, and they hate the guy. Associating him with us means that, you know, it's okay to hate him, and it's okay to make war on him. This is something that never even happened during the Cold War. So now you have an international...
And it comes together, actually, with Hillary Clinton. That's something I kind of want to talk about, too. So, you know, of course, she talked about the great right-wing conspiracy in the early 90s that you're mentioning. And today, I mean, in her speech she gave last week, it's this very tinfoil hat conspiracy theory of everyone from the alt-right on Twitter calling out, you know, especially Jewish journalists, if you could even call them that, and their lies, calling out the far left, supporting nationalist policies to organizations like ours, the Traditionalist Worker Party, all the way to Vladimir Putin, that there's this, there's supposedly this strong conspiracy where President Putin is behind, like, Pepe memes on Twitter. And that's the view of now the far left, that everyone is locked in together. And it seems to me this is like a dehumanization of our worldview. We're not actually allowed to critique multiculturalism. We're not allowed to critique globalism. We're not allowed to reject these things. Because essentially they're calling us agents of a foreign power just for being upset about the dispossession of our people and the destruction of our culture and disagreeing with these political street movements that oppose us, that use economic terrorism, use threats, and even use physical violence to attempt to silence us. So, you know, in what world does this conspiracy make any sense other than these are just the forces that are opposed to globalism? I mean, do you see this as kind of rehashing what Hillary talked about the right-wing conspiracy in the 90s, that this is just coming back with a new face? Is this just a continuation of these policies?
I had just started grad school in 93. OKC happened in 94. The speeches that were made after the Oklahoma City bombing were almost identical to the things that Hillary was saying. A few, you know, names were different, but adding a foreign power changes everything. It's been my opinion that the regime is looking for war with Russia and China, or China, or both, since they have a defense treaty. It has to be both, a war that they can't win, but at the very least, mobilizing is the only way possibly to get the U.S. out of its eternal depression. All China has to do is dump these dollars in the market, and the U.S. is finished. I'm not sure what the end game is here, but to distract attention, to create this external enemy, this nationalist, you know, opponent that everyone is allowed to hate, the neoconservatives, mainline conservatives, liberals, you know, the full coalition, all believing the same mythology. It doesn't make any sense factually, but, you know, in all my experience in this movement, I keep forgetting that truth isn't that important to people. Self-interest, power, getting rid of your opponents, that's what's important, and they'll believe anything. If it works.
Now, do you think this is something, especially if Hillary Clinton is elected, that's something that we should be, I mean, you know, when we get in this movement, you take it seriously and understand that you can lose jobs, you can be attacked on the street, you might even give your life for this cause. But the entire idea of adding in the Russians as supposedly being the ones who are pushing all of this, I mean, do you think if Hillary Clinton is elected that this could be used as a pretext for viewing us kind of in the 1950s, if you look at like the CPUSA and other organizations like that, you know, that were put under intense scrutiny, people were dragged in front of Congress, people were arrested, you know, for being communists. And of course, it was never the full weight of the system, because for every Joe McCarthy, you had three people in the Soviet payroll or who were sympathetic to the communists. I mean, that's why, of course, Stalin was able to go ahead and get the bomb two decades before we estimated he was going to be able to do it because of people within our own government that were leaking these files, this research, this information. McCarthy was right, but he was also wrong with not understanding how deep the infiltration of the American government went, of course. But do you think that this could be used, if Hillary wins especially, as a pretext for more repressive measures against nationalists? Because when it's gotten so far, we're not talking about, we're involved on the streets, and that's so crucial to carve out political space. But they're talking about Twitter, they're talking about Facebook, they're talking about people expressing nationalist sentiment through social media as apparently being a threat to democracy. So do you think if Hillary is elected, this could possibly lead to hate speech laws like we see in Europe or more government repression or things like that, like we saw in the 50s against the Reds, being used against nationalists under a Hillary Clinton presidency?
Well, that's a bad example. I mean, no one was ever arrested. Joe McCarthy didn't have that kind of power. The U.S. capitalist class was heavily invested in the USSR, was profiting heavily from them. I think maybe at the beginning of World War II, FDR tried to round up Hamilton Fish and Gerald L.K. Smith and Henry Ford, tried to send them off to prison. That failed. But I think what you mean is that she would label us an agent of a foreign power. She wants war with Russia and China. Has not given a reason yet as to why. This is it's very misty. We know why, but these are obscure areas. People don't know anything about them. So they can believe whatever they want. But being agents of foreign powers, justifying a war, and then at the same time, eliminating this dissent in this country, that's precisely what it's for. The regime has spent a lot of time demonizing Vladimir Putin for no clear reason. He's not threatened anybody, not threatened the U.S. He's very popular. But he's a nationalist. He's done things without Washington, without the IMF, without the bankers, allied with China, has promoted the church and everything else. He's done everything that you're not allowed to do in America, and has become more and more popular as a result of it. This is the main reason why they hate him.
Perhaps a better example might be you mentioned FDR. Father Coughlin was the number one radio host in America. The League of Union of Social Justice had millions of members, literally thousands of chapters, along with the America First Committee throughout the United States. And of course, what did they do? In the first kind of hate speech laws in American history, what they did was they banned Father Coughlin from being able to use the airwaves. They banned him from being able to send his publications, his letters and things like that through the mail. So even though they didn't arrest him, they actively made it impossible to be able to use the media of the day to be able to address people. Going from the number one radio host in America, where, as a Catholic priest, when Catholicism, even 20 years later, JFK had to talk about being a Catholic and about how he was a good American. So, pro-Catholic sentiment was not very strong within America, in the 30s and 40s. But it was something like one out of four families, in some areas, one out of three, would listen every week to Father Coughlin talk about wanting to stay out of the war, talking about the Jewish oligarchs, talking about globalism and capitalism and communism being threats to our people, and especially working families, the farmers, normal everyday people, and to shut him off the airways, to shut him off from using the mail. And then, of course, you had groups like the Silver Shirts under William Dudley Paley, where they were all arrested. The German-American Bund was essentially shut down overnight. The America First Committee was shut down overnight, and they were also banned from being able to use the airwaves, hold meetings and things like that. Is that more of a thing? Because there is then an American context where that was never really challenged in the courts with a victory for our side, that if they viewed it as a war, they could really just shut us down from being able to use, getting our message out there through mediums of media. So do you think that might be something that Hillary Clinton would do to make, basically, if you're on the alt-right, if you're a nationalist, basically labeling us like they labeled Father Coughlin, where they won't, they're not going to drag us into prison because that would delegitimize them, but say that our ideas are against American values, against American interests, and try and shut us off the airwaves, where shows like this would be essentially illegal? Do you think that's something that they might do? Because they've done it before, and that was very successful in crushing a true nationalist movement in the United States. But I think the internet, of course, is a different game. But for public people like ourselves, it'd be very difficult to flaunt, a law like that, of course, because they know who we are. It'd be harder for anonymous people on Twitter and social media or blogs. But for us public people, that's definitely a problem Do you think they might try and follow a Father Coughlin model to deny us yeah. the public space to be able to reach the masses? And then basically right. they're just stuck with a Pravda-style propaganda press through the approved kosher, you know, the kosher approved media.
Oh, that, you're exactly correct. That was my point. I brought up the treason trial, the attempted roundup of all of FDR's opponents in 1940, 1941. It didn't work in the 30s when the Supreme Court had struck down some aspects of the New Deal. All FDR did is appoint more people to the court, expanded it to 9 people. Yeah, extremely arrogant thing to do. No one said a word. Abraham Lincoln did far worse than that during the Civil War. Bringing in a foreign power makes it more dangerous for them, but it also gives them a justification. The minute there's any kind of real war, I mean, there's sanctions right now, but the minute there's any kind of real warfare, they will, in their minds, have the right to shut us down completely. The press doesn't even have to cover it. You know, we see what happened to Edgar Steele. That still gives me nightmares. You know, they killed the guy. You know, they saw how far they can get away with, and they got away with it. No one said a word about it, except for a handful of our people.
Well, exactly. I mean, things like Matt Hale, for instance. You know, Matt Hale, you know, being arrested for not properly fully denouncing an informant who was attempting to entrap him, and he denounced that, but apparently, you know, didn't do it hard enough, and that was a justification as Matt Hale was making real inroads and growing the creativity movement. And I, of course, have a lot of critiques of their views, especially on Christianity and things like that. That's neither here nor there, but they use this government repression to lock him up. And that is a little terrifying, but it's something we have to accept, of course, as nationalists, that this is something that we're living for something greater than ourselves, and sacrifices have to be made. But it's definitely not something that, you know, you tuck yourself into bed and think positively on about happening. But where do you think we go? What do you think is the best way to do things? And, you know, I never like to be a Debbie Downer because I think things, especially in the United States, are growing. I was listening even to an interview about the alternative right that Heidi Beirich of the Southern Poverty Law Center was in, where she admitted they always love to downplay nationalism. They always love to. Saying that the alt-right, in terms of really dedicated members through social media, through blogs, organizations, things like that, that there's a million of us or more. And that's a hard thing for them to admit because they love to say, you know, nationalism is dying. It's only old men, and having to cope with the fact that this is a very youthful movement. It's the youngest the nationalist movement's been in America in generations, probably, if, you know, it might possibly even be ever. Having to admit that there's at least a million of us. And if they were willing to admit there's a million of us, there's more than that. And this is overwhelmingly a young people's movement. So how do you think they can cope with that? With obviously our sentiments are reaching audiences on a scale that that they never thought possible before, and all of their tactics of indoctrination and propaganda aren't working.
Well, I think you've already answered that question. Founding groups with Rockefeller money, like SDS or PLP, these violent leftist groups. There's a strong racial element there, non-white racial element, heavily Jewish element. They will be let loose on us. It's happened before. The media doesn't even have to cover it. If the press, you know, if they want to arrest one of us and kill us in prison, you know, if they put enough pressure on people, it won't be reported at all. And then if it is reported, you know, they'll say neo-Nazi kills himself in prison, and everyone will buy it. So the only thing we can do in terms of retaliation is, number one, keep our nose clean, get rid of anybody who, you know, because they would love violent acts from our side. Those people have to be gotten rid of as quickly as possible. Number two, have babies. I'm telling you, you know, having children and raising them properly is the best form of activism you can imagine. Number three, have alternative structures. Hopefully the rudiments of an alternative economy, helping one another in the simplest way possible, at least to begin with. And number four, to be prepared. If the electric grid goes down or something like that, we have to be prepared to survive. We have to have a plan in place. We have to be able to work together and form an ad hoc commune if something really hits the fan. You've heard Black Lives Matter and other groups are saying that if Trump is elected, they're going to make America ungovernable. And other groups have said this as well.
Well, exactly. I mean, and it hits on, you know, with especially cleaning house within our movement, that people need to understand that, you know, like you said, having families, building our movement, and keeping our nose clean, then repression against us delegitimizes the system. I mean, the Irish Republican movement learned that, I think, very well, that the greatest propaganda boom they ever had was, for instance, after Bloody Sunday, where they had a peaceful march, and the marchers were killed, and it delegitimized, in the eyes of many people that had been on the fence, in favor of the Irish Republican movement, you know. But when you try and go and fight and things like that against a numerically superior foe, they have no chance of defeating. It delegitimizes us. I mean, one thing you mentioned in one of your speeches a couple months ago that I was reading recently about in the Ukraine, where there were partisans who were fighting the Soviet occupation, and the Soviets would actually dress up their soldiers as partisans, as, you know, Hitlerite partisans and stuff like that, and go in and do massacres in villages or be very cruel to people on collective farms and stuff. And then that would turn the people against the actual nationalists, when it wasn't even them. It was the Soviets who were just trying to scare people away from any sort of national sentiment. And that's something that we also need to be on guard for, I think, that the system, if they can't provoke or entrap us to do something, that it's not beyond them. I mean, this is something that has happened in world history recently, to try and delegitimize the nationalist cause by committing atrocities or things like that, and blaming us when it was actually at their hand. You know, I don't go into the false flag and stuff, you know, very often at all. But like in the USSR, they did that a lot. You know, is that something that you think maybe a Hillary Clinton America, if they can't provoke us into overreacting, if we're growing and doing things legally and peacefully, that they might try and do?
Well, the Oklahoma City bombing was kind of a test case there, because they immediately blamed that on the militia movement within 5 minutes of the thing blowing up. There's no evidence for that whatsoever. It doesn't matter. That's now being reported as history now, as fact. I've said before that if the regime gets frightened enough and their backs against the wall, they'll massacre a bunch of kids in the playground, and they'll Photoshop me and you there, and everyone will buy it. If they certainly have the technology to do that, no problem. It'll look just like it. And most people will say, well, they got pictures. Look at those two psychos. They've done it with ISIS, with bad Photoshop.
People buy. Like when they claim, you know, like, oh, you're conspiracy theorists. Like, the Soviets are the great example of you know, doing things like this. And of course, pardon me, the you know, the U.S. was allies with the Soviet Union at the time that this was going on. So this you know, these massacres were being done with American bullets and American gasoline and American jeeps and stuff like that that the Soviets were using and doing these sorts of things. So, I mean, do you think, because we're kind of coming to the end of our show, and I want to leave on a positive note, because if the system might have to resort to things like this, it means they're scared and they see that nationalism is rising, tradition is rising. Do you really think, and I think so myself, that the best way forward is to be able to do peaceful, legal, political action, because repression against us, and if we win the hearts and minds of the people, they won't believe the propaganda. If they know us on a personal level, if we're the ones fixing a widow's roof or feeding the hungry or helping the drug addicted, helping mobilize the workers to get jobs with justice and things like that, then that's the best way for us, that the government propaganda would just fall like water off a duck's back. Because the people really get to know us. Our biggest foe in this is the people not knowing us and not being able to know us on a real personal level, so the government can lie about us. But if they have a real relationship with us, it's much harder to demonize us, and then the system is far less likely to try those tactics because they know it won't work.
The Soviet Union appeared to be this monolithic, powerful global empire. Solzhenitsyn is sitting in prison with cancer, of all things, dying. Could he at that time possibly have thought of himself in Moscow in the ashes of that empire just a generation later? That's exactly what happened. It was totally unpredictable. These things happen all the time. And it wasn't the Soviet Union didn't fall because an army invaded it or because a plague broke out. It was a rottenness of the system itself. It just collapsed. No one really believed it anymore. And something like that, like the U.S. regime, all it takes is a little push. The Chinese say, we're not going to buy your debt anymore. That could be it. You know, so you think of the Soviet Union. I mean, this massive empire overnight is destroyed. This empire right now is just as irrational as that one. And Solzhenitsyn lives to from prison to being victorious over it and a hero of the entire country.
Well, and I think that's a really inspirational thing for us to remember, is that You know, everything about the American regime is illegitimate because it's based on principles that are against natural law. I mean, you know, God's law, of course, comes, he created natural law, so of course we follow that. But everything about it is artificial, and every ethnic community in America is unhappy of the way things are going. And politically, people are losing faith in the system, and they're becoming more self-reliant. We're moving towards communes. We're living in, and working towards being able to build things for ourselves. So the identity crisis of the regime is already in full effect, especially considering the last people upholding the American system really are like the white patriots. You know, in the South, we've got Stockholm Syndrome. We were invaded by America, and then we waved the flag harder than everybody. But it's coming to a point where those people, especially at the Hillary presidency, when they've polled Texas Republicans, two-thirds of them say under a Hillary Clinton presidency, they would support secession. So that tells us that that things are already happening. The dominoes are already falling. It just happens in slow motion. But things can pick up very rapidly, as you say, with the Soviet Union. It went from, or Ceausescu in Romania, you know, he went from being in total control of the country to that system being overthrown by a people's revolt, essentially, a relatively bloodless and peaceful one. People just stopped believing in the system in a very quick period of time. So as we come to the end of our show, Dr. Johnson, is there any other final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with, to give them a little inspiration for what we're building and how things are progressing?
Yes. I mean, the regime is scared. We've already said it. They see us as a threat. That doesn't exactly bespeak of a secure, happy group of people. Their time is coming. There's no question about it. But they can still lash out. When a wounded animal is in a corner, that's when they're the most dangerous. We have to be extremely careful.
I totally agree. And we're going to keep building. We're going to keep our noses clean, as you said. And we're going to build a true revival of our people politically, economically, socially, and religiously. We're going to rebuild our families, and this empire will be coming to an end. Globalism is on the retreat, and they know it, and we know it. So it's a great time to be a nationalist. So thank you, as always, Dr. Johnson, for being with me. Thank you to my listeners. And I'll look forward to being with you tomorrow and for the rest of the week for the Daily Traditionalists. And thank you guys so much for tuning in, as always. So thank you, Dr. Johnson. Thank you to my listeners and to everyone. Hail victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.